Hey everyone, welcome back to the High Percentage Podcast, and today we are doing the process episode, which I am excited but also terrified about, and I'll tell you why. So a week ago, I was talking with a guy on Instagram, and him and his buddy actually run a podcast called Grappling Rewind, and I actually checked out the podcast. I recommend it if you're into kind of competitive jiu-jitsu events. They cover them every week or so. They do their podcast and they kind of recap everything. The big pay-per-view events like Polaris and Kasai, but they also do the IBJJF circuit. And they're actually really, really knowledgeable about the different BJJ players, like to the point where it was embarrassing for me because I'm like, hey, this is basically my job and I don't even know who some of these guys are. We were talking on Instagram on direct message, and he said, hey, I really am curious about like how you collect the data. And I said, well, I talk about that all the time in my articles. And he said, well, I don't really read your articles. I just listen to podcasts. And I was like, oh, of course you do. And that's something I've been learning, is that people that listen to the podcast don't necessarily read the articles on the site, in which I talk pretty often about how we gather the information. So I was like, well, that's an episode right there. That's great. And actually, Grappling Rewind is not the only one that has suggested this. I was talking to another guy that runs an Instagram page, Footlock Fire, and he had sort of the same question. So I was like, all right, let's do a process episode. So before I get into the nitty gritty, I wanted to start with a big picture, which is there's a couple like ground rules that when we bring on new kind of researchers that are going to help us watch the matches, we always say from the outset, okay, this is the philosophy that we approach when we're recording the matches. And I'm going to break it down to kind of the core tenets. The first tenet is we have to acknowledge that we're always going to be working with limited data, which is that we watch these fights, all of them on YouTube, and the information is always limited in some way. We don't know who the competitors are. We don't always know the weight classes. We don't always know which event it was, where it was held, what year it was held in. So in that sense, we're always limited to some extent, and we recognize that we have limitations, and we just do the best we can to work within them. All research and all studies has limitations. Limitations don't invalidate the studies or the research. They're just things that need to be kind of disclosed up front so that people are aware of it. Second tenet is we go wide, not tall, which is that we're trying to collect data that is going to provide the greatest number of information to the greatest amount of people. That's one of the reasons why I tend to focus on white and blue belts, because they make up the majority of the training population in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and also they need the most information. By the time you become purple, brown, black belt, you kind of got your thing down, and of course you're still open to change and you're still evolving, but you're making little adjustments, not necessarily big radical changes, whereas white and blue belts, they're in the phase where they are, which is why I want to focus them. And also, in terms of volume, they are the most matches that are, you know, available for public viewing. So it's very, very easy to find lots and lots of white and blue belt matches. The philosophy of wide, not tall is also why you're probably not going to see any articles specifically saying we watched 1,000 people doing single leg X guard on High Percentage anytime soon. Because one, that is going to only be useful for a smaller amount of people. But also, think about this. If you really wanted to do a study gauging people's effectiveness in something like single leg X, well, you have to go find those videos. And you have to pull up, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu blue belt match. And then you have to watch an entire match in which it's possible no single leg X was played. And then you set that down and you move on to the next one. So when you have to hunt out specific positions and situations, it becomes very, very difficult, if not impossible, in terms of efficiency. So that's why we have a wide, not tall philosophy. Third tenet is we try to minimize subjectivity, which is that we want to record data that it is as undisputable as possible. And this is something that we've changed over time. So when I started High Percentage, I was watching all of the fights myself. So it was a little bit easier for me to be consistent with what I defined as a certain technique. And what I would do is I would actually write them down. This came up a lot in the beginning with submission attempts, which gets very, very tricky. What do you consider a submission attempt? Because there's really no definition. And if you look at IBJJF rules, they don't really score submission attempts unless the referee feels that the opponent was in imminent danger of tapping, which is not the same as just an attempt. And the reason IBJJF does that is because it's very hard to define what you consider an attempt. Is it someone that they got the position, but they couldn't finish it? They started getting the position, they got interrupted halfway through. It gets too messy. And in the beginning, I could do it by myself. But once we started having two, three people helping me, what we found was that even amongst the three of us, we disagreed on what we considered was a submission attempt. So we started moving away from that. And what I'm a big fan of is, like, let's eliminate the subjective data, because I don't want people looking at matches that we did and saying, well, I don't really consider that a sweep attempt or a submission attempt. That's not really fair. So we're trying to find things that is very black and white. Did you score a point? Did you get a takedown? Obviously, did you get the submission? Stuff like that. On this note, there are some times when the data is just too juicy to pass up and we make a decision, okay, we have to record this, even though there is a degree of subjectiveness to it. And what we do in that case is we write out, okay, these are the three checkboxes that need to be hit in order to consider this a takedown attempt. And we did have a thing for a takedown attempts, which we said, okay, two of these three things have to happen in order for us to consider it. And off the top of my head, I don't remember what it was. And I think we changed it a little bit later. And that kind of leads into the fourth tenet, which is that we sort of follow the Kaizen principle. John Donaher, if you follow him, he's a big fan of Kaizen. I'm a big fan of Kaizen, which is that we are always making small improvements. We recognize that as we collect and record data, sometimes we find unintended consequences of the way that we categorize certain things. And we're always willing to go back and say, okay, like, is there a better way to do it this time? And that's helped us make improvements and get better at the way that we do things. The last big pillar, and we're up to five, if you've been keeping track, is that we always think about efficiency of data collection. And what essentially that comes down to is, you know, we run a website, we want to post content on it every week if I can. And in order to do that, we need to narrow the scope of the data that we collect. Because if we wanted to use the most statistically appropriate sample size, you know, we'd be watching a few hundred matches. And we could be collecting tons and tons of data points. But if that happens, you know, the production of content would kind of grind to a halt. So we have to pick our shots. And what that comes down to with efficient data collecting is we try to ask simple questions. Okay, we're going to watch a match. Was there a submission? Yes or no? If the answer was yes, timestamp it. And then subtract the time at the beginning of the match where there was no action happening. And then maybe we add one more thing. Okay, mark what the submission was. But then beyond that, we got to a point at one point where it was taking us like 5 to 7 minutes to watch a single match because we were collecting too much data. And even though we were collecting a lot of data and just that one study would provide several articles worth of content maybe, it just wasn't efficient. So we decided to flip it and say, okay, like, let's answer less questions, but keep the content coming. We save all the matches that we do. We save all the URLs and all the timestamps so that it's easy for us to kind of dip into that pool. And that's worked really well because over time, because we have this huge backlog of spreadsheets and data, it's getting easier for us to collect the data from the matches over time. Okay, so those are the five pillars. Man, I don't even think I can remember them right now if I had to review them. Rewind it if you need to. Now I'm going to talk about mechanically, I guess, how we actually do it. Okay, so nowadays there's about three of us at any given time. We watch the matches. We find them all from YouTube. I don't really see a need to use another platform. There's so many matches available. We have not had the problem of running out of matches to watch. In fact, we don't even often reuse old matches because there's just a lot of fresh ones that come around. We always check each other's work. So what we'll do is, let's say I watched 100 matches, which usually we'll break it up. So we'll each watch it, but like 33 matches or something like that. And then we'll check each other's matches. And the rule is we kind of follow the 10% rule. We check 10% of each other's matches. And what we usually say is 8 out of 10 of them need to be correct. If there's ones that aren't correct, we mark it on a shared Google Doc that we use, and then we'll go back and we'll say, okay, what happened? Sometimes with certain points of data, like things like submission attempts or takedown attempts, which get subjective, sometimes we'll need to huddle and we'll say, okay, like, what's the verdict on this? Is it a takedown attempt or not? And then we kind of follow a 2 out of 3 rule, which is, 2 out of 3 of us need to agree. What I've been doing lately is if there's disagreement, I just don't use it because there's so many matches that, it's not worth arguing over one match. So when in doubt, we tend to drop it. And all those things put together, multiple of us collecting the data, we write out the standards. Okay, this is what we all agree is going to be considered a takedown. This is what we all agree is considered a guard position. Like when we talk about a guard position, we have a 3-second rule. If you are in closed guard for 2 seconds, we don't count it as being in that guard in the match. And that's an example of we use IBJJF. In IBJJF, they use the 3-second rule, 3 seconds for a guard pass, 3 seconds for a back take. So we kind of use similar rules. Like if we're going to record all the guards that competitors are using, we want to have 3 seconds. And that just seems fair. And then we can say, okay, we're kind of trying to fall in line with what IBJJF is doing. And then the fact that we check each other's work and that we have kind of a minimum standard of accuracy, nothing can be 100% accurate. We get that. But this is a way for us to kind of make sure it's as accurate as possible. And also that we're monitoring each other and sort of keeping each other up because the people that help me watch the fights, I do pay them. So, I mean, this is a job. So we all kind of have standards that we have to meet. And it's our job to kind of check each other and make sure that we're kind of earning our money, quote unquote. Some of the major distinctions that we look at with matches that we watch is obviously we look at belt level and we look at gi versus no gi. Other things that we do is we look at rule set and time limit. Rule set is sometimes tricky because you don't know what the rule set is, so you can kind of surmise, but the main indicator that we have for rule set is time limit. If it's a 5-minute match, it's probably going to be IBJJF rules, particularly if it's in a gi. So that's usually an assumption that we make, although we haven't really done any studies that are specifically looking at rule sets, so that hasn't come up as much. If it's a 10 or a 20-minute match, then clearly it's not IBJJF, it's a different rule set. And then sometimes there's other indicators, like if there's Naga on the mats, then you understand that it's a Naga match. And sometimes if we really needed to, we could go look up, okay, what's the rule set for like a Grappling X or Grappling Industries or a Naga or something like that. Some of the things that we do not take into account is we don't take into account males versus females. We do not take into account weight class. We do not take into account the age bracket. And we do not take into account what circuit of competition it is, whether it's the actual IBJJF circuit or something like a Grappling X or a BJJ Tour. And I'm going to tell you why for all those things, and it's basically the same answer, which is you cannot consistently know. Except for gender. You can know the gender, but some of that was based out of practicality, which is, okay, are we going to really record the difference between males and female competitors? Well, one, it's if we ever want to do a study, and I'm not saying we won't, but if we ever did want to do a study saying, okay, let's just look at female competitors, one, that would be considerably more difficult because they're in a minority of competitors. I don't think it'd be impossible. I see it as not as big an issue to just sort of lump them all into one. I have no hard data to support this, but just anecdotally, I don't really see a significant difference in the way that males and females compete. Maybe they're using slightly different positions, but I mean, they're training together, they're using the same moves, they're probably competing using the same moves. What are the other things? Okay, weight. We can't really take weight into account because we don't know the weights. And sometimes people mark it on the YouTube titles, but if they don't, we can't do it. And it's too much, it's too challenging to go and hunt out the different weights. Other thing is, as far as the actual tournament circuit, the brand name of what tournaments they're on, we also don't take that into account because, again, we really can't. You cannot often tell from a YouTube video what the tournament is or where it is. Sometimes you can. I mentioned, Naga, they put their brand name on the mats. IBJJF, they have those kind of iconic blue and yellow mats. But sometimes with other promotions, it's not sure. And even if you did look at, so the argument here is, well, maybe IBJJF events attract a higher caliber of competitor. And if you were to just look at them versus, you know, something in rural Wisconsin, a local tournament, it might skew the results. Now, is there something to that? Maybe, maybe not. So one thing is IBJJF, they do a lot of events, including some events in rural areas or smaller metropolitan areas. So it's not fair to say anymore that IBJJF is just always doing these premier world-class events. They've expanded their circuits, so I don't think that's fair to make too much of a distinction. Two, I cannot tell where these events are or where they're taking place half the time. So even if I wanted to, I'm not really sure how I would. Three, if we did want to break all the events up into, like, you know, the amateur and the pro circuit, that would mean right off the bat twice as much work, right? Because then you'd have to start dividing every match into whether it was, you know, a big thing like the Pan Ams or the Worlds or a small thing. And then, you know, there's far less matches available in things like just the Pan Ams and the World. So you're kind of like splitting your sample size up a lot. There's a lot of sort of unintended consequences that could come with that. And my philosophy is, let's use the law of large numbers, which is eventually, you know, we've already watched over 1,000 fights and we're going to be closing in on 2,000 and 3,000, probably faster than we closed in on one. Eventually, the law of large numbers will take over and the statistics will kind of even out. With all that being said, one thing that I think would be interesting is one year to look at a major event. And I talk about the Worlds a lot because that's sort of the big one people know about. But, you know, there's hundreds of matches that are recorded at the Worlds and the Masters Worlds every year. So there'd be enough that we could do a study of, you know, the blue and purple belts at the Worlds, and then we could compare them to kind of the general population. The problem there is that the general population would also include people that had competed at the Worlds to a degree that I'm not sure about. But it's still, you know, something is better than nothing. And I think it would be kind of cool and probably doable to say, okay, like, we're going to collect the same data that we did with another study, but we're only going to look at athletes that were at, you know, this top level event. And maybe we could learn something from that. That's the other thing about these studies is sometimes we put a lot of work into them and we look at the end and we realize, like, it's not useful at all. And we did that recently with a sweep study. I don't remember what it was, but we didn't even post it because we're like, it's freaking useless. And it was frustrating because, you know, we had spent a lot of time doing that. But that's just how it is. Sometimes you don't learn anything. And that's the nature of statistics. And it's also the nature of, you know, at High Percentage, like, we're doing something that there's not really a playbook for. So we're trying to figure out as we go along too. The last thing I want to mention that we do not take into account, two things. Okay, so we don't look at the age of the competitors. Again, we can't know that consistently. The other is we don't look at the age of the matches. And this came up recently because I was watching a really grainy match and I looked into it and it was like from 2008. And it's a legitimate thing that, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was different in 2008. You know, positions come in and out of popularity. Almost all the videos that we watch are fairly recent, you know, within the last 5 to 6 years. But even within 5 to 6 years, I totally get that the sport has changed. But again, I don't really know a solution for that. Are we going to start dating all the videos? What do we do when there's no dates there? You know, and then what's the cutoff point? So with that, and really with everything that I talked about, if you have a solution that is actually practical, I'd love to know what it is, because like I said, there's ways that we can get better. And some of these problems I consider kind of minor, because right now there's so much really great data that we can be collecting. I think it'll be a while before I get so starved for content that I'm like, okay, we need to do an article on, you know, rooster weights versus light featherweights. But I could see a day where that happens. I mean, certainly it seems reasonable to me that you know, people in the cruiserweight division are doing a completely different kind of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu than people in the light featherweight division. So at some point, it'd be really interesting to get into that. We just have to think hard about what is a practical way to do that that's accurate. Glad I could get that off my chest. I hope that was informative and helpful for people that listened. And just know that, you know, when we do this kind of research, it's important to me and everyone at High Percentage that we do it with as much integrity as we can. We do it with, you know, a reasonable amount of transparency. And that also, you know, we have good intentions and that, you know, when mistakes are made, we're willing to kind of go back and address them, figure out what happened and evolve so that everything just gets tighter and we all sort of get smarter together. That's sort of the bottom line, I guess, with High Percentage. Thank you guys for listening to this podcast. I'm going to have some new content up on the site. Hopefully this week we're blasting through a few hundred matches for what I think is going to be a really big article. And next week, I wrote a self-defense article that's been sort of a big hit, and I'm going to be talking about it next week. Other than that, have a great week of training. See you soon.